Hello, everyone. My name is, welcome to the What's New in Microsoft Azure Infrastructure as a Service session. My name is Christine Evanesians. I'm one of the program managers on the Azure Runtime team. Here with me is my colleague and co-presenter, Guy Bowerman.
Hello.
So just to get acclimated and to kind of give you guys an idea of what we're going to be talking about today, the goal of this session is actually to talk about all the new features that we've been working on in roughly the last 6 months. We expect that you have some familiarity with infrastructure as a service. Either you attended the previous session done by Corey Sanders and George Moore yesterday, which was an introduction to IaaS, or you have worked or are currently working with infrastructure as a service. The goal of this session is to actually give you sort of that overview and breadth of all the new features. We will dive deep, do demos for some of these features, and we will also point you and guide you to some of the additional sessions that will go very in-depth into certain topics. Oops. So I'm sure I don't actually have to convince you that pretty much cloud is a fact of life. Regardless, it's still always very fascinating to think about all where we are today and where we are going tomorrow. Some of the things we consider and which we will refer back to are some of these interesting data points. Businesses will spend $107 billion on cloud-delivered IT services in 2017. 85% of commercial applications now developed are specifically for the cloud. You'll see a lot of the efforts we are doing in our marketplace and in a lot of the topics we talk about later on in this presentation. Enterprise and service IT infrastructure spending to build and to enable cloud services are growing at 20% per year, reaching $65 billion in 2017. And by 2020, 40% of servers will be in service providers' data centers. This is up from 13% in 2011, and mostly from the expansion of the cloud. So as we continue on, and as we think and expand on the feature sets, the functionality, we really are trying to deliver the industry's most complete cloud. We are focusing on how we can make our cloud your data center. I apologize, I keep pressing the button on my laptop because I have that set up for demos and I keep forgetting that the deck is on another machine. So if we think about Azure and what is unique and how we differentiate ourselves, we sort of sit at the center and focus on three key areas, from hyperscale to enterprise grade and hybrid and consistency. We are one of the few cloud providers where we try to focus and actually strengthen all three of these simultaneously. Throughout the deck, throughout this session, we will be touching upon the features that fit within one of these three focus areas. From the additional data centers that we're opening up to the sheer volume and numbers that we have on our platform to the actual features and functionality for enterprise, our security ecosystem, the compliance certifications we have from SOC 1 and SOC 2 to HIPAA and all the other items that you may have heard in one of the other sessions, to the infrastructure and identity and data to ensure consistency between hybrid cloud, on-premise cloud, and the public cloud. So for this session, there's three major sections where we've loosely related each of the features and functionality. I'll be walking through the first section and a half, and then I'll be transferring it over to my co-presenter. So one of the first sections, which I get to pretty much walk through each of the features that really make our data centers and our cloud bigger, faster, and more open. So if we look at the slide that I have up here, this was a slide that we actually presented in Tech Ed North America. It's always fun to actually show where we were just a few months ago and be able to pretty much cross out every single one of those numbers and just show how quickly we really are growing. From 30 trillion storage objects to 1.2 SQL databases in Azure, 3 million requests per second, 18 billion authentications per week, and just how geographically distributed we are in very much a global presence with 19 worldwide regions. Walking through some of the recent announcements, just only a few days ago, we announced that we have two new regions in Australia. These are open for Australian residents. They have many of the same GA services available as in other locations. A few months back, we also announced Azure VM support in North Central US and South Central US. These are our data centers in Illinois and Texas, respectively. Both regions offer basic support, standard support, as well as A8 and A9 support. Finally, we have our government cloud, where we've added two new US regions specifically as a government offering. We are GA for services such as IaaS, PaaS, storage, and networking services. The key caveat here is there is a Microsoft vetting process to actually ensure that the community criteria is actually met because it is a government cloud. At this time, most of our standard A series sizes are actually available. And finally, a very recent announcement as well. The 19 is actually a 19 and counting. We've already committed to data centers in India that will be coming soon. So if we take a quick look, we have a very strong presence in the Americas with the two new government cloud data centers, Europe, Asia, Australia, and we also have our regions in China, which are actually part of Microsoft's Azure, but operated by locally. So now getting to focus on the bigger and faster aspects, there are many new VM sizes that we've introduced that are currently GA and a few that will be coming soon. So we'll dig into some of these sizes in a little bit more detail. There's a set of additional A-series sizes that we've added, the A8 and A9. They are meant to be compute intensive sizes. They have high-speed multi-core CPUs with, as you can see, significant amount of memory. They have two network adapters, where one is actually connected to to a 10 gigabit per second Ethernet, which is meant for connections to Azure services such as storage and virtual networks, and to the internet. The other one is a 40 gigabit per second InfiniBand backend network. It is RDMA capable, and it enables and with a 32 gigabit per second effective speed. It is recommended that these sizes actually be placed in a virtual network. They are meant for HPC applications, such as computational fluid dynamics, finite element analysis, weather forecasting. They really are the sort of workhorse VM sizes. There are a few small unsupported scenarios. So because these are specialized compute and they are meant to be compute intensive, they are separate clusters for these particular VMs. So switching between sizes like A8 and an A9 and to standard sizes is not supported. Or similarly, if you actually have a hosted service that has standard VMs in there, you cannot actually place these sizes into those existing hosted services. So the fun part is I'm going to get to say, you know, and now we have another set of sizes and they're faster and they're bigger and they're they're better. So if we take a quick look, we have just actually only a few weeks ago announced our D series VMs. These are 60% faster than the standard A series VMs. The big difference here is they are SSD backed, so you actually do have a large temporary drive. If we actually take a look between the CPU and memory ratio for these general purpose virtual machines, so the D1 to D4, it's actually a 1 to 3.5 ratio, which is actually 2 times better than that of the standard A series VMs, which is 1 to 1.75. For the actual high memory VMs, the D11 to D14, it's a 1 to 7 ratio, which is similar to the standard VMs. So these particular virtual machines are best for workloads that can leverage the temporary drive, either for replication, redundancy, or caching. The platform isn't actually going to be doing the caching, so your application needs to make use of it. So examples being MongoDB for the replication of data across instances to ensure that there is no data loss due to a server failure. And another example being the SQL Server buffer pool extensions, where with the buffer management, which is meant to actually cache IOs and to speed up IO efficiency for the SQL Server, the pool can actually be extended to the SSDs. So at this time, I'm actually going to switch, and I'm going to do a quick demo just to show you how the D series is pretty much similar to any other virtual machine, and to actually enable the SQL buffer pool extension. If I go in here, and of course it logged me out. Apologies, I was logged out, so just one moment. So throughout this presentation, we're actually going to be switching between our current management portal, which is the portal that you have likely been using up until this point. We will also be working and doing some of our demos in the new Ibiza portal. So we'll kind of switch. The UIs do look very, very different, so just to call it out. So if I were to just go quickly pick a compute virtual machines and from the gallery, I want to actually go ahead and deploy a SQL Server. I am going to use the 2014 Enterprise Edition with SQL Server Standard Edition. There is actually a limitation on the amount of memory that SQL Server can use, and so for this particular demo, since I want to actually go ahead and utilize the majority of the SSDs, I do want to have the full memory size available. So I go ahead, I mean, this should be pretty much second nature to you. You either have been doing this through the portal or through PowerShell. So if I do tech ed MIA demo SQL, and with our standard size, you know, all the A series as we were talking about, the A8 and A9, and now all of the D series. So I'm actually going to go ahead and deploy a D4. In the interest of time, since I think most of these steps would be second nature, I have gone ahead and deployed a virtual machine with exactly the configuration I want. So so far, this virtual machine just has SQL Server Enterprise, and it's a D4 machine, which is actually 8 core and 28 GB. So if I actually were to remote into that machine, and there should have been a RDP file on my desktop, but that's okay. We can just connect from from the portal. So generally from the SQL buffer pool extension, the buffer pool size is slightly less than actually the SQL server memory size, which is slightly less than the VM memory size. So as we actually go ahead and configure the buffer pool extension, we're going to usually use the guidance of roughly 4 to 6 times the VM memory size. So I actually have the steps here that we're going to walk through just so that I can cut and paste some of these actual steps without having to do too much typing manually. So initially, since we are going to move the temporary database drive onto the D drive, we're going to go ahead and create that on the local disk. So if I look here, I have the C, which was the OS disk, and I have the temporary storage on D. So I'll quickly go ahead and create a new folder here, calling it tempdb. And then we can continue on. So the next step is I have SQL Server Management Studio open here. I've gone ahead and just opened up all the applications that I needed. I am going to go and connect to the SQL Server. And so the next step is to actually move the tempdb files to the actual D drive, to that folder that we went ahead and created. So I'm going to create a new query. I have a few simple steps here. I'm actually going to close the properties window. So really all this is doing is saying that the tempdb, the dev and log files should just go to these locations, which are now going to be on the D drive. So if I go ahead and execute this, we succeed. So now that we've actually moved the tempdb files, we should go ahead and configure the buffer pool extension. So really all we need to specify is the file name as well as the size. And as I was mentioning, for the size, we generally recommend 4 to 6 times the VM memory size, which will be optimal. So I go ahead. Oops, I re-executed the same thing. I actually wanted a new query here. Go ahead. So the virtual machine has 28 GB. I've just done 5 times that. Go ahead and execute it. So we actually have most of the configuration complete. Next step is to actually go ahead and go into the configuration manager and make sure that we actually set both the SQL Server and the SQL Server agent to a manual start mode. And it will be clear in just a few seconds as to why we want to make sure these have a manual start. Okay. So from this perspective, we've actually done everything and the SQL buffer pool extension has been configured. But we're not quite done yet. Because the D drive is a temporary drive, there is a chance that what is on the D drive will be lost, especially during a service healing when the virtual machine changes hosts. So we actually have to ensure and guarantee that this will persist between service healing instances. So there's a few additional steps. I've gone ahead and created a simple script that every time on startup, we're going to configure it such that this PowerShell script actually run. All it goes and does is create the tempdb folder if it doesn't exist, and it makes sure to start the services. Part of why we, in the previous step, went and made sure that the services were manual was during that startup time, we don't actually want to have a race condition. So that's actually saved as a .ps1 file on the desktop, so there isn't anything that I will show for that particular step. Finally, I just have to do one quick change to the PowerShell execution policy here, since the script that I have created is not signed. So in this particular case, I'm going to allow for an unsigned script as long as it's not actually been a downloaded script. Say yes, and we're nearly done. So the final piece that we actually have to do is go and make sure that we have this scheduled task that is going to run this PowerShell script. So that's also fairly straightforward. I have the task scheduler on hand here, and I'm going to go ahead and create a basic task. I'm going to call it SQL startup. I want to do it every time when the computer starts, just to make sure that at some point in time, when there is a service healing, the VM would have restarted. I want to start a program. In this particular case, I do want to start up PowerShell, so I'm just going to copy the long file path here. And I just have to give it an argument, the actual PowerShell file that I want run. I go ahead and do next, and pretty much I'm done. And so every time the VM restarts, this will actually go ahead, it'll check, and so the folder will be created, and of course SQL Server will always recopy over the files if it doesn't actually find them there, and we are able to have the buffer pool actually extend into the SSDs and really leverage those SSDs. So as I mentioned, I always get to say bigger and better. So we have the G series VMs that are coming soon. I mean, really simply put, they're extremely large VMs. They have more memory and local SSD than any other VM size in the public cloud right now, and they're leveraging the latest Intel processors, the E5 V3 family. So just wanted to call out, throughout this presentation, you'll actually see a little green box sometimes on some of the slides at the top. These are the sessions that we point you to if you are interested in learning more about some of these topics. For these particular sections, we are going to do we will discuss them in some extent, but we really encourage you, if you are interested in what we're saying, for you to actually attend those sessions. And at the very end, we'll actually have a slide that kind of summarizes all the different sessions that have related content. So at WPC, we actually announced a new program called the Azure Certified Program. And this is an opportunity to actually bring software providers and customers, consumers, the enterprises together. If we think back to some of the statistics I mentioned about the 80% of commercially available applications are actually developed for cloud in mind, we realize that it's really important to bring that rich ecosystem of applications and workloads to Azure. So you can think of this program actually in two fronts. There, from the perspective of if you're a software provider, and from the perspective of a customer. So if we think about it from the perspective of the software provider, the person who's actually going to be publishing the images that you will see in the VM marketplace, this is a partnership between Microsoft and each of these publishers. There's a set of guidance as to how to actually create the VHDs. There's a set of validation steps and a certification process that these applications go through to ensure that they will work well on Azure. On top of which, there is actually the program provides marketing support as well for the partner and publisher. It's an opportunity to actually go ahead and sell and monetize your applications and to be a part and to have access to all the Azure customers. As part of this program, we also have a few exciting new additions. The ability for partners to actually redistribute Windows and SQL Server on the cloud, to be able to actually put that third-party commercial software on top of Windows. Now, if we were to think about it from the customer's perspective, you know, it sounds like it's a program actually for the publishers, not the consumers. But it is in our effort to actually have a very large and open ecosystem. We also do want to ensure the quality and the content that we actually put in. We want to make sure that when you do go to the VM Marketplace, to the gallery, and we will go there in a few minutes, that the applications you see are trusted partners, that they have gone through the steps and the validation and the certification to actually ensure that what you're running will work. So we actually have the ability, the images that we will see, they are in two flavors. There's the BYOL, so when you go in ahead and deploy a virtual machine with an image that was through the VM Marketplace, you still need to go back to the partner, to that publisher, and actually get a license key, the standard bring your own sort of license model. But there is a new model of actually hourly billing that the publisher can provide the actual price that they want to charge for the IP, that software layer. And from a customer's perspective, you'll get one bill. You'll get the bill from Microsoft, and it'll be divided for the actual hardware cost, the infrastructure that you're consuming, as well as the IP costs of that third party. So we do have a growing collection. At WPC, we had partnered with several key early adopting publishers to actually start the VM Marketplace. In just a few months, we have added 42 partners, 50 plus unique workloads, and 80 plus total images. We have a set of these partners displayed here of what you can go and see and explore in the new Ibiza portal today. So if I actually will now switch over to do a very simple demo and kind of show the VM Marketplace. So I'm actually going to log out of that SQL Server remote machine that we were running. And I will go here to the marketplace. And OK, so just to make sure, I was just testing it here, make sure I hadn't been logged out. If I go back home, by default, you'll see this square, the marketplace here. If we click on that, if we go to the virtual machines, these are all the images that we have that you can do pretty much a first party, easy and accessible and fast deployment from. As you can see, we have a large security and protection ecosystem, a lot of Linux-based, open-source, commercially-based applications. If we go ahead and click on one of these applications, I'm just going to one here. So as you can see, we have SoftNAS here. They have multiple different offerings. This is the bring your own license. So once you go ahead and deploy it, you would still need a license. There is actually here the hourly billing model. We do have the support for free trials as well. So I could go ahead and deploy it. I actually have one deployed that is hourly, and it's currently on the free trial portion. It's a 30-day free trial. If I go ahead and click create here. As you can see, if you have worked in the Ibiza portal before, this is our new preview portal, the create experience is a little bit different. But if you were to go and deploy a Windows image, which is kind of one of the core platform images, versus one of these new VM Marketplace images, the experience will actually be the same. You will actually be able to, if you are interested in these third-party applications, if you go ahead and view the pricing summary, and hopefully this will load in a moment, you'll actually see the price for the standard VM, as I was saying, and then the price for the actual IP. And as you can see, it says the free during the trial, and $66.96, and that's why for the first month there's a slight difference in pricing. So as I mentioned earlier, the next section of this presentation will be about all the features that are really targeted and focused on the enterprise, from the security related features to the networking features, to really make our cloud your data center so they can easily move those enterprise applications that have very large and strict requirements up into the Azure cloud easily. So recently, very recently actually, we announced our premium storage offering. We realized that enterprise workloads require fast and predictable response times. They cannot withstand pauses or gaps without impact. So the premium storage is an SSD-based storage. Right now, it is meant for blobs. It enables high level of disk performance, consistent low latency to run IO-intensive workloads. Like with anything in storage, there are three replicas within the region. We're looking at single-digit milliseconds, and a preview will be available soon in the U.S. and Europe. As we get close in the coming weeks, we will reveal more and more details about this offering. So in addition to the actual premium storage, we have a set of premium storage VMs. These are going to be similar to the D-Series, and the key difference is that you will be able to actually attach premium storage disks to the virtual machine. You will have support to up to 32 disks for the larger sizes. You can achieve greater than 50,000 IOPS per VM for some of these larger sizes. You did see a demo by Mark Rasanovich showing this particular aspect. And one of the key pieces about these particular VMs is it is actually going to sit on a new host compute architecture. As part of this updated host layer, we do have a new local cache that's been implemented. It's been optimized for small queue depths and with roughly a 1 millisecond latency. So we're going to dig into the cache. Right now, we've just been kind of calling it the ABC cache, the Azure Blob Cache. So it is a host-level caching mechanism. It is tiered. It's using the actual hardware on the host for caching these reads and writes. So as in the D series, the SSDs were provided to you for the application to use them and do the, whatever it would with it. This is actually the platform and the system providing the cache. And the big thing here is, focus on optimizing on the low IO latency. So if we take a quick look. So if I have two virtual machines, there are a few differences between some of the other standard VMs and this particular premium storage virtual machine. There is a new throttling layer, and the throttling is actually done on a per VM basis. And there are actually dedicated cache pools for VMs. So if you think about this, this really means there's no more noisy neighbor. And so they are completely isolated, and they're completely dedicated to that particular virtual machine. And if we continue on, just to kind of take a rough look at it architecturally, so we have the guest partition, we actually have the virtual machine, we have the root partition, and XStore. And so if we took the no caching scenario, I mean, when you are trying to go and read a particular page, it will go through the hypervisor to translate into the actual page that you want. In this case, since it is no caching, the actual cache is simply a pass-through, and all the reads and writes are actually going to hit the Azure storage. And you're going to see storage performance. If we take the read-write caching policy, which is the default that we use for OS disks, it's very similar. For reads, though, it will hit the host hardware here. I'm referring to the hardware generically. As we mentioned, it is a tiered cache, so it's leveraging various levels of the hardware. So the reads, if it's a cache hit, great. It will be surfaced up even faster. If it's a miss, it will of course go to the storage service. Similarly, for writes, it will hit the cache and surface back, and you'll have a lazy write. As mentioned, the hits and misses. For the read-only caching, the only difference really is the fact that writes will be written through to the storage service. So now I'm going to do a quick little demo here between a standard virtual machine and a premium storage. So just quickly to describe the demo. So I will be, actually we have a 5VM deployment of Dynamics CRM, which is a customer relationship management software suite, really meant to be a sales productivity and marketing effectiveness. It's a suite to actually drive sales productivity and marketing effectiveness. So the actual deployment looks something like this, where you have a web server, you have a SQL server, you have the async servers, which we don't have to worry about right now, but they're meant for batch processing, a domain controller, because the application allows you to actually create domains and domain join. And the test controller. So it is a single organization with 320 user accounts. There is a large amount of pre-populated data in the database, and we're actually going ahead and running a large amount of load on this. So I'm actually now, once again, going to switch over. If we go back here. So I'm actually now connected to two virtual machines. And I actually need to close this for a moment. So as you can see, we are actually running load. I've been actually running the load now for nearly an hour to an hour and hour and a half almost. And so I just wanted to actually kind of talk through the results here. So this one, the first graph, is actually the premium storage. I have some of the performance counters actually listed here. As you can see, for the SQL box, we're roughly at 15% processor time on average. We have 7.5 disk writes per second, 75 disk reads, roughly 307 disk transfers. So this actual SQL box is really not under that much load, even though we're actually running a load test. Versus here, actually, you see a processor time for the SQL box of roughly 41. So you're seeing that for the exact same, I mean, it's the same topology, it's the same workload that's actually being run, and this SQL box is actually starting to get under stress. You see roughly 6.5, 75, and 252. So in addition, the premium storage VM is actually delivering higher transfers per second, and here you can actually see that the variability in the graph versus four. It's fairly steady. You know, there is an initial; it's about half an hour for the load test to kind of reach the a steady state. So the first half an hour you kind of have to ignore, but you can see it's fairly consistent. And if we just quickly on the premium VM, if we actually go into the application here. So I have gone into the application. Let me go back home. There is a slight bit of lag only because these VMs are actually in the US and not because of the fact that it's XIO. But you can actually see right now CRM is actually only in approved for dev test workloads in Azure, but as you can see running on XIO, it's actually quite responsive, and the load is still going on, so I haven't actually turned this off, and I can fairly quickly actually open these pages. There is actually a lot of content on this page, and it's loading fairly quickly. So this is just one of the workloads on, under a particular load test that we can actually see for Azure, for premium VMs. So one of the other new features that we have are Azure Files. They're built on the same underlying platform technology as the blob table and queue storage. So very much so, it's really about exposing file shares with SMB 2.1 protocol. And it really allows you to easily share files between the VMs or access directly via REST. So if you can think of the applications, if you have on-premise applications where your machines actually need access to a file share for a variety of different scenarios, to share configuration files or essential store for diagnostic files, you can actually go and reproduce that in Azure. And since, as I mentioned, it's on the same underlying storage platform, it's the same availability, durability, scalability, geo-redundancy, all of those good pieces as the storage server or other storage services. So just some quick numbers. You can get up to 5 terabytes per share, with each file being up to 1 terabyte, 1,000 IOPS per share, and 60 megabytes per second per share. So I'm going to walk through one final demo just to show you how easy it is to actually create the Azure file shares. So I have Azure PowerShell open. I also have my little script over here to walk us through each of the steps. So the first step, which I've already done, which is the simply creating a new Azure storage context, I've given it the name of my storage account and I've given it the key. So just in the interest so that I didn't actually show you the plain text key of the storage account, I've already gone ahead and entered it. So if I were to create a new file share, it is as simple as calling the commandlet new Azure storage share, naming the file share, so I'm going to call it Azure file share, and providing the context. So if I cut and paste over here, as simple as that, and I've already created the file share. So now I can actually go ahead and create different directories in the share. Surprise, surprise, commandlet being the new Azure storage directory. I pass in the share and I can pass in the path. So if I just pass in the directory name, I've just created a directory within the share. We do support subdirectories as well, so I can actually provide it a longer path. So I'm actually going to create a subdirectory within the directory I just created as well. To actually go ahead and upload files into the file share, you just provide the share, the source. So I have a hello world.txt file sitting in my documents. And I think I may have missed the path. There was an extra return. So close, getting through the demos without any red errors. And so once again, I've now created the file. So if I were to go ahead, I can, of course, list everything within a particular directory. So you can actually see the file, the hello world.txt that we just uploaded, and the subdirectory that I created. I can go ahead and, if I really wanted to actually prove that the file was there and then I can re-download it, I can go ahead and download the file. So I've gone ahead and downloaded it now in my downloads, and it's the Hello World text file that I had uploaded. And of course, like anything else, I can go ahead and remove the Azure storage file itself. So I can go ahead and say remove the file from the share and giving it the path and say yes. So very easy to work with a few simple commandlets, and you have all the flexibility of the shares and files and directories. So moving into the backup and migration scenario. So again, if we're thinking enterprise, all the things that I had on premise, all the things that I want in the cloud to be able to do everything easily and efficiently. So soon we will actually have Azure VMs with Azure Backup. So we are providing the support to actually do consistent snapshots of a running VM. We have a new backup extension that leverages VSS on the actual machine to go ahead and do full and differential backups, everything that you think that you know that you can do with VSS, this extension is going to be able to do. And you'll actually see, Guy will actually be walking you through many other extensions and actually the full power of extensions. And there will be support for on-demand and scheduled backups. So if we take a quick look at the steps, so there's a one-time initialization of the actual backup. So I would go into the portal, I'd click on backup restore option. I'd pass in a set of relevant configuration information. For example, how frequently I want to backup, what VM I want to backup, and so forth. It'll go through the workflow orchestration. It will first go ahead and create a backup storage account. It will store the configuration in the storage table of how frequently you want it to backup and all of that. It will go and through the Azure Service Management layer, actually go ahead and through the guest agent install the particular backup extension. So if we were to run through the on-demand backup flow where I just want to trigger a backup, first I would say, you know, kick off the backup. It would go through the workflow orchestration. Once again, it would call the Azure Service Management layer, and it'll push down the modification through an extension configuration update. So it's talking to the extension. It's actually telling it to go ahead and take the snapshot. So the service management layer will actually talk to the extension. It will go and say, you know, do the backup. So if I had three VHDs here attached to the virtual machine, I would get my copy. This would, in this particular case with an on-demand, you'd likely be doing a full snapshot. Oops. Finally, it will actually go ahead and update the backup details so that you know that there is this particular instance of the backup. And finally, the workflow orchestrator will ensure that it takes a snapshot of all the rest of the VM config, not just the storage profile that we took a backup here through VSS and store it once again in the storage account. So at this point, I'd like to transition over to my colleague, and he will walk you through the next part of the session.
Thanks, Christine. So that was backup. Let's now talk about migration. If you're bringing enterprise workloads into Azure from on-premises, for example, then it's essential that VM migration is easy. And by easy, I mean inexpensive, preferably free. It should be simple, not lots and lots of complex steps. And probably most important of all, there should be minimal downtime of your production workloads involved. So I'm going to talk about Microsoft Migration Accelerator. Anyone here heard of it? Okay, a smattering. This is a product that came from Microsoft's acquisition of a company called InMarge in summer. And then in September, Microsoft Migration Accelerator was announced in preview. And what it really tries to address is the problem of downtime. So if you imagine, say, you want to convert a VM from a virtual machine from VMware, you're going to have to shut the machine down, copy the files, convert the files, upload them to Azure. Maybe there's lots of data files too. That's potentially hours of downtime. Now, suppose you need to move 100 VMs. We're talking a major project lasting days or weeks. So what Migration Accelerator does is effectively a live migration, where you establish replication of disk writes. And then once you've established replication, you can cut over, and your downtime is potentially minutes. So let's just take a look at how that works. And as I said, this is in preview at the moment. Oh, and it's free. So you download Migration Accelerator from a portal. And what that does, it installs an agent in your VMs. And there's also a process server, which is another virtual machine. And the process server actually captures those disk writes, and it compresses and encrypts them, which is important, in preparation to send it over a data channel to the destination in Azure. And notice this supports Hyper-V, VMware, AWS. I'm not sure if the Hyper-V is ready yet or that's coming soon. Also, it's currently Windows, but it's going to be supporting Linux soon as well. And then these writes, they go to what's called a master target, which is just used for a repository, and it builds up disks. And the config server, that manages the whole process. Now, in terms of the actual steps for migration, it's basically three steps. There's a discovery phase. So, for example, you put in your credentials for AWS. It can go find what VMs you have. Then there's a protection phase. What that means is it establishes replications. Then you've got replication running from the target to the source. Sorry, from the source to the target. And if at that point the source dies, then you can fail over. And then when you're ready, you can then hit the migrate button, and that will effectively cut over. Your production workload comes live on Azure. And as I say, the downtime is potentially minutes. So this has been called disruptive. I mean, it's a real game changer. I will mention that we also have other partners that, for example, Vision Solutions has a product called Double Take Move, which they also have a live migration, which is very easy to use. And it's probably worth checking out both. In the Azure Marketplace, they've actually got Double Take Move, several images that you can use for different operating system versions. So it's worth going there and investigating that as well. We certainly use both. We use Migration Accelerator. We use Double Take Move. That's like MSIT in Microsoft. So that's migration. Now I'm going to talk about security and what some of the new innovations in security. Now, security is, all surveys show, it's the number one concern of enterprise customers using public cloud, particularly infrastructure as a service, because there we say the operating system, the middleware, the app layer, even the networking, you have responsibility for security there. I'm going to be looking at innovations in five areas of security: anti-malware, encryption, log management, patching, and network security. Now, we have borrowed a slide from the introduction to Azure session from yesterday, because it's a good starting point for the security features. And this really represents Azure security in terms of concentric rings, where we take care of the first, for example, physical security, where, I don't know if you ever visited an Azure data center. Most of you probably haven't, because it's not easy to do. And there's cameras, there's alarms, there's 24/7 security, there's barriers. It's usually a plain drab building that doesn't say what it is. And it's kind of a menacing place that's very hard to get in. And if it loses power, it can keep going for days. So there's very advanced physical security. Infrastructure, we have compliance certifiers visiting all the time. It's kind of secure by design. There's a whole load of operational security controls. I don't have access to go and see what these guys do, because I don't need access. It's very strictly monitored. And if there is an attempt at breaking in, there's forensics. And we pay people to do penetration testing all the time as well. Now, when it comes to security that you have some responsibility for, it's very important that we provide tools for you that make that easier. And that's where we've been focusing recently. The easier we can make that, particularly to manage security at scale, or to do the same security that you can do on premises, the easier it is to bring those workloads into Azure. So I'm going to be going through some of the new networking features. And then similarly, at a VM level, where again, you control the VM, we've got several new security features in these areas, and I'll go through them one by one. But it's nice to kind of picture it in this concentric, as a set of concentric rings of security, where the inner two, you have some responsibility. A lot of the security features are issued in the form of extensions. And extensions are very useful. They basically let you customize your VM in a secure fashion. So there's a strong partner ecosystem of extensions, and these are curated and in Azure. So you don't go out of Azure to load an extension. And if you write an extension, then anyone, any VM, you can effectively install that extension and customize your VM. So you can run a VM from PowerShell or from the Azure console or from Visual Studio for that matter. There's an agent running inside your VM, which can then, when you deploy an extension, it can go to this curated extension marketplace, go get the extensions that you want. It can run them, and then you can keep configuring them afterwards. Plus, it's got automatic update as well. And you're ready to go. So with that in mind, talk about the first extension. This is a partner extension by McAfee. It's their endpoint protection, and it's basically three products in one. So you can, when you install this extension, you can choose anti-malware, browser protection, which is based on the McAfee Site Advisor engine, or firewall, or all three. There's also relay server support. So if you have VMs in a subnet that don't have internet access, you can designate a relay server, which can those VMs can then get their updates from. It comes as a trial, and you can put an entitlement key in at any time. Next, I'll talk about the Microsoft Anti-Malware GA. You may have seen this in preview before. So as of this week, this is now GA. It's free. It's antivirus for Windows. It works with all Azure Compute roles, so worker role, web role, virtual machine. You can specify real-time or scheduled antivirus. You configure it from the portal or PowerShell. You don't configure it from the VM itself, so you can have that kind of central control. And then it's got integrated monitoring with Azure Diagnostics or Operational Insights. I'm going to do a very quick demo of what it looks like to install and use that. So I'll switch over to my machine. I hope the portal is still logged in. Here's one of my virtual machines. I'm going to scroll down to Extensions. I'm going to click Add. And then I'm going to go to Microsoft Anti-Malware. I'm going to create this extension. There's various options that included. These options weren't there in the preview, so these are kind of new. And I'm going to put one option. I'm going to say exclude text files, just so I can customize it slightly. So I'm going to say don't scan text files, but I will say real-time protection. So I'll go ahead and create that. So then it will be creating. It takes a couple of minutes to create, and then maybe 5 minutes for it actually to kick in and run. So I'm going to take a machine that I already installed, and I'm logged onto it here. But this has the Microsoft Anti-Malware running. So I'm going to start a browser. And this browser, I'm going to go to my favorite website, which is called Free Stuff. And I kind of trust this website because it says guaranteed. And particularly this link, it says 100% legit. So I think that seems pretty reasonable. So I'm going to try clicking on this link. And then right away it pops up, malware detected. Microsoft Security Client is taking action to clean detected malware. So right away it got it. It didn't let me go and download that. Now, of course, I wasn't really downloading a live virus. I was downloading a virus signature. So I got this from a security site. And if we try and download a text file containing a virus signature, it actually lets me do it, because when I configured the malware, I specified don't check text files. So that's the Microsoft Anti-Malware. I will switch back to PowerPoint. And move to Alert Logic Log Manager. So if you're concerned about security, managing logs is very important. And what if you have a lot of VMs? It's really nice to be able to have a central place where your logs can be consolidated from your virtual machines. And what this extension does is installs an agent which then sends log info to a central place. It has all sorts of functionality, like integrating and analyzing security logs from various sources. It searches logs. It gives you proactive notification of compliance violations or potential compliance violations. They also have their central server in the Azure Marketplace. So there's various options that you can choose, bring your own license or pay per hour. So then you can basically integrate it all together. And they actually have a booth here as well in the exhibition hall. And the guy, Rohit, he did say to me, show them the bouncy ball and tell them you'll get one if you go visit their booth. So who says I can't do marketing? Who says I shouldn't be allowed in front of customers? All right. Another great feature is patching for Linux. So Windows patching, Microsoft's been doing that for a while, but now there's an extension that lets you automate Linux VMOS patches. So you can you've got various options. You can schedule to set a patch automatically or as a one-off. It's not in the portal yet, so you install it with PowerShell or the cross-platform CLI. Anyone heard of the cross-platform CLI? This is anything you can do with PowerShell with Azure, you can basically do it with the cross-platform CLI, but it can run on any platform. It's based on Node.js, so it's really useful command line interface. The extension status itself does get reported back to Azure. It's open source, so I've included the GitHub link here. Here's an example of installing this extension with the cross-platform CLI. You could do it with PowerShell as well. So here I'm saying, I think this laser pointer is a bit weak, but here I'm saying basically check for patches every week on Sundays and Wednesdays at 3 a.m. Just check for important and recommended patches. Use the operating system's automatic reboot. In other words, leave it to the operating system to decide whether to reboot, and only check for half an hour. So it's a very simple single-line installation of Linux patching, and it works with all the major flavors of Linux as well. This is a really nice, useful feature. And then one of the most asked security questions that we get are, can you encrypt Azure data at rest? Can I encrypt my OS drive? Can I encrypt my data drive? Well, with Cloud Link Secure VM Agent, the answer is yes. It leverages BitLocker. So basically, you get your regular BitLocker install, but it does pre-boot authorization, and it has a key store. So that's basically how it manages it. It does image integrity validation as well. There's a centralized management tool. So you can go to the centralized location, manage all your VMs, and manage the key store. So this is really nice kind of off-site key management. You can lose your keys. You can work with Cloud Link, get your keys back. It's got some really great features. And at last, we can say, yes, encryption of data at rest in Azure is not a problem. And also, there's a couple of in the Azure Marketplace. Like we're seeing a lot with these extensions, they're partnering with images in the marketplace. There's a Cloud Link for Cloud Link Secure VM with a 25 VM license. There's also one with a 5 VM license. So you can go and install this from the marketplace as well. Next, I'm going to run through some. I'm going to quickly run through some network security features, partly because there was a very detailed network session earlier this morning, which you can go and reference. And also, I think in the intro, we went through some of these. So I'll just quickly run through them, since they are very important. One is network security groups. Basically means you can designate a set of network traffic rules, call them a security group, and you can put them around a subnet. So that lets you control access between machines in different subnets. So you can basically apply rules to a subnet in a VM. This is really nice for like separating front-end machines from web servers. That have internet access like web servers, and then back-end database servers that don't have internet access. So it just gives you the level of control that you kind of expect on-premises that you can now do in Azure. Another great feature is multiple NICs. So having multiple network interface cards is standard for things like network appliances. It just lets you tightly control access to different subnets. You can put internet traffic on your primary NIC, and then you can apply static IP addresses to back-end NICs, for example. So this is now available. You can't do it in the portal yet. You would use PowerShell. So here's an example where I just created a VM, I got my VM object, and now I'm just passing it to add Azure network interface config. And I'm just doing this twice, I get two network interface cards. So it's a very easy to configure feature. Next, I'll talk about forced tunneling. So before this feature, your internet traffic in a VM, if it was going to the internet, it would go directly to the internet. It would basically bypass your corporate security, any web content filtering. Now you can force all internet traffic to go through a VPN tunnel. So therefore, you can get the compliance you need. So again, another very important feature. Next, we'll look at client-based IP affinity. Here, if a client, say, goes through a load balancer, like at the level 4 of the IP stack, it connects to various VMs. Once it's connected to a VM, it has state, basically. And for performance reasons, it'd be nice if it connect back to the same client to keep the same session state. So that's what client-based affinity does. And instead of the usual 5 pieces of information, like source IP, source port, destination IP, destination port, protocol type, it lets you choose 2 or 3 pieces of information to do the load balancing with, and that lets you connect back to the same port. So I'll go through a quick example. Here's your client, load balancer, virtual machines. The client is using this 5-tuple. It connects to virtual machine 1. If it reconnected, it could go anywhere else. But if it's using client-based IP affinity, use 3 pieces of information, and it will go back. The same session for the client, if it disconnects, it will go back to machine 1. So a very useful feature. Now I'm going to move on to application and development features, application development testing. And this is really how do you make deployment and configurations of applications easier in Azure VMs. I'm going to start by looking at the DSC extension. The DSC, desired state configuration, is based on PowerShell, and it's hugely useful for configuring. So it's becoming the standard now for Windows configuration. This is an extension that you can deploy. And you can deploy to multiple VMs with a simple script. And also, I heard today that Linux support is coming for this in the next version of DSC as well. That was actually surprised me. I did not realize that. So I'm going to now move to a demo, which is deploying a website with DSC and using the DSC extension. So I'm going to go to another VM. And I'm going to go to this VM. And here, I'm going to go down to extensions and add an extension. So here's my installed extensions. As you see, I'm doing all these demos with the new portal. And it's working, which is good. So I go to a new extension. I scroll down, I find PowerShell desired state configuration, and I click create. Now, what I want to do here, I'm going to load a zip file, and I'll tell you what this zip file does in a moment. So the zip file is called website deploy. And then I have a cheat sheet here to load the information that I need. So, this is the one I need. So I'm going to put in this module, which is basically part of the script, a module in the script, which is going to deploy my website. So what I'll do is I will show you what this script does in the PowerShell editor. This is the configuration file that's been put into a zip. What this does is various configuration options. So it's going to install IIS, for example. It'll install ASP.NET if it's not already installed. If there is a default website, it will stop it. I hope you can read this okay. It will copy website content. I have a website content for a coffee shop. And then it's going to then set up this coffee shop bakery website. So that's what the extension will do. Let's go ahead and create this. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to... VM that I've already set up and installed this DSC extension. And what I'll do here is I'll go and look at settings. I'll go look at properties. I'll look at the domain name. And then I will go to this domain name. Having configured the extension, that's basically all I need to do. One little script, and it comes up with the website. And it's actually so simple. I'm very, very impressed with DSC. Here's an example. This I may need to zoom in. This is an example of the first-party modules that the DSC configuration is available for. It's a whole load of different features. Of different products. And then there's a healthy ecosystem of third-party modules as well. So that's DSC. And I'm going to switch back to the presentation. So that was configuration management. I'll talk about release management now. Visual Studio Release Manager is a great way to do release management. You can create a template that describes a release workflow. And then you can define release stages for your app, like pre-production, production, testing. And then you can deploy your app to VMs for any release stage. This is deployable as an extension. And that, what that does is it really cuts out a lot of the steps. If you're setting up Visual Studio Release Manager and you want a set of VMs to deploy different stages of your release to. Again, very useful. I've included a link for more information. Tell me, is anyone familiar with Octopus? How many people? Okay, a few. Octopus does deployment as well. What's good about Octopus is it's really focused on deployment. It doesn't do build. It doesn't do the whole release management lifecycle. It just does deployment very well. So there's an agent that, if you install the agent, then Octopus server can push ASP.NET applications to your websites, ASP.NET websites, Windows services, and any applications and scripts directly to your VM. Octopus, I'll do a quick demo of Octopus. So let's switch to my machine. And I'm going to go to, actually, I'll use the same machine. So I will go to down to extensions. I've got two extensions currently installed. That's my PowerShell. I'm going to add Octopus Deploy Tentacle Agent. Create. Now, to save a bit of time, I have a cheat sheet. So I will put in the URL. This is where my Octopus server is installed. And then a key. This is the API key. And then I will, for the role, I will use, well, for the environment, I will use Azure. And then for the listen port is 10933. Now, if I'm adding this, I will have to remember to go and create an endpoint for the VM as well for the same port. And that's my role. So I'll go ahead and create this extension. Now what I'm going to do, again, to try and save time, is I'll go to where I already created, I've already installed this Octopus extension into one of my virtual machines. And I'm going to go get the IP address for this. And then I'm going to go to my Octopus deploy environment. And I'm going to go add this machine here. So it'll go and discover it. Now, if it's not going to work, I may blame whether this demo has enough licenses. But it's thinking about it. But that's basically the steps. So, okay, so it didn't establish a connection with this. But if I go back to environments, it basically, when it works, it adds your machine here, and then your environment is ready to go and install Octopus. So that's application development. And I think we're within about 2 minutes. We had one extra section that if we had enough time, we were going to go through. But we decided we were going to leave it in the notes anyway about VM images, because it's a really useful feature to be able to capture a whole VM image with disks and then deploy it again later. So we left the notes in here for future reference. But I think we will wrap up. So just to summarize, there is a huge number of Azure features announced this week. I'm not even sure we actually captured them all here, but these are some of the ones we've been talking about in our session. And really worth taking the time to learn about these. So much is changing. We basically got rid of all our content from the What's New session in TechEd North America, and we replaced it with stuff that's being announced now. And I think if you look at these features, it kind of shows how Azure differentiates with its enterprise features, managing at scale, and hybrid features. It also shows we've done a significant amount of work with partners, also making a lot of use of the extension infrastructure and also the image marketplace and the extension marketplace as well. And I think, really, in summary, it shows the maturity of our management infrastructure and how it's based on open standards and partnerships. So that's all. We're going to be around for questions. I've got links to related content. So we'll hang around here for a while. But anyway, thanks a lot for attending. And do come and chat.